Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Nurses Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, Senior Veterinary Nurse at Anderson Moores Veterinary Specialists, Denise Prisk. Thank you, Denise. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Emma. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this webinar. So this afternoon, we're going to look at anaesthesia for patients with head injury, and in particular, those with traumatic brain injury. Brain injury presents itself in many different ways, and because the brain is such a complex organ, there's quite a lot that can go wrong with it, and it does take a lot of understanding. So to that end, I've divided the webinar into several sections in a bid to cover the main points. We're going to look at pre-anaesthetic assessment and think about the best ways that we can manage brain injured patients under anaesthesia. But I'm going to start off with some anatomy and physiology of the brain, because we do need to be able to understand certain parts of anatomy and physiology to understand how the brain works. So first of all, the skull is a rigid box-like structure, and the neurocranium is the dorsal and caudal part. So it's this top bit here, and it goes around the back. So that's what we call the neurocranium. The rest of the skull is just the facial skeleton, and the cranial vault is the space in the neurocranium. So that's that bit here. I've just done it with a red outline, and that's the space in the neurocranium where the brain is found, and I've put at the bottom there that we've got blood, cerebrospinal fluid, and brain tissue, and we'll look at that just now. So of the cranial vault, roughly 80% of it is taken up with brain tissue, and then roughly 12% is blood and 8% is cerebrospinal fluid. So you can see the red bits are denoting blood, and the green wavy lines just there to denote cerebrospinal fluid. Other texts say that it might be 10% blood and 10% CSF, but largely we've got brain tissue. So there isn't any room for anything else, because this is all a rigid box. It doesn't expand. And so I'm going to come back to it shortly, but these blue arrows denote intracranial pressure, and you can see that there just isn't really any room for anything else in this space at all. So there are lots of confusing terms and abbreviations, and we do need to be able to understand some of them to have a grasp on how the brain works. And the three that I've listed here are all linked to each other. So cerebral blood flow is simply the flow of blood to the brain. That's what perfuses the brain, but that's regulated by the cerebral perfusion pressure, which is the pressure gradient that causes blood to flow to the brain. Now, without this gradient, blood simply won't flow to the brain, and the brain doesn't then become perfused. It is the mean arterial pressure minus the intracranial pressure, or it may be minus the central venous pressure if that one's highest. And cerebral perfusion pressure must be maintained within normal limits to allow normal, constant blood to flow to the brain. And one thing to just be aware of is that the mean arterial pressure, the MAP as we abbreviate it to, is the main driver for cerebral blood flow, and therefore the one that keeps the brain perfused with blood. And so if the blood pressure decreases, that MAP decreases, or if intracranial pressure increases, then brain perfusion is decreased. And so we can maintain cerebral perfusion by either increasing the mean arterial pressure or decreasing intracranial pressure. In people, the Brain Trauma Foundation guidelines target a mean arterial pressure of about 50 to 70 millimetres of mercury in traumatic brain injured patients, and that's in conscious patients. Finally, the bottom one, cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen consumption, that's, as it says, it's the consumption rate, and that is linked with the cerebral blood flow. So when cerebral blood flow increases, so too does the cerebral metabolic rate of oxygen consumption. So they are confusing, those terms, but they are worth just spending a little bit of time getting to be familiar with them. Intracranial pressure then is the pressure exerted between the cranial vault and what is inside it. And so, as we said, what should be inside it is just brain tissue, blood and cerebrospinal fluid. And as intracranial pressure increases, neurological status decreases. And I don't know if you can see here, but this is an MRI section of the brain. And in the middle of the brain here, we've got quite a large space-occupying lesion here, which is a tumour. And this is exerting pressure on the cranial vault. We don't measure intracranial pressure in veterinary patients, and certainly not in dogs and cats. So we need to rely on mentation and neurological signs to tell us if we think it's rising. Autoregulation. In the healthy brain, autoregulation is the normal homeostasis that keeps intracranial pressure in the functional range. So cerebral vessels will alter their tone with changes in blood pressure, changes in blood gases, and also body temperature. So that's what should happen in a healthy brain. But when autoregulation fails, the intracranial pressure just carries on rising until it equals the systolic arterial pressure. And at that point, cerebral blood flow stops because we've lost the pressure gradient that's needed. And this is called vasoparalysis. Cognitive function and consciousness are lost when cerebral blood flow is disrupted. The brain receives about 15% of the cardiac output. It's somewhere in the range between 14 and 19-20%, so it's not a huge amount compared with other organs, but it does need that 15% of the cardiac output. It doesn't tolerate ischemia at all well. There are various levels of consciousness, from high to low, and as intracranial pressure rises, there's progression from the higher to the lower levels. So you can see here at the top, with a normal patient, normal alert responsive, it has a normal response to a stimulus. And then as we go down the levels of consciousness, we become obtunded. That's a patient that's depressed. It's conscious, it's awake, but it doesn't have a fast response to a stimulus, so it's quite sluggish. And then going lower still, we have a stuporous patient. This one is only semi-comatose, and it would only respond to a stimulus if it were really vigorous or really very painful. And then the lowest level that we can get to is unconsciousness, and this patient is comatose, and it's completely unresponsive to any stimulus. The Cushing reflex, which I'm sure everyone's heard of, is a hypothalamic response to ischemia, and it indicates rising intracranial pressure. So it's the brain's method of trying to save itself. It is a life-threatening condition. You may also see the Cushing reflex referred to as the cerebral ischemic response. So it is a reflex reaction, and it is trying to do good things. The reason it happens is it's trying to save brain tissue during periods of poor perfusion. So when there's not much flow to the brain, we've got some form of cerebral ischemia going on, then the Cushing reflex kicks in. But it is a late sign of increasing intracranial pressure, and brainstem herniation is imminent. And in the MRI diagram just down here, I don't know if you can see, but we have quite a large degree of brainstem herniation. So unfortunately, the brain is coming out of the back of the skull. The Cushing reflex itself comprises hypertension, so a really high blood blood pressure, bradycardia, which is a slow heart rate, and abnormal respirations. And when all three components are present, it's called the Cushing triad, but the terms are used synonymously. So we will often refer to the Cushing triad, even though you might not necessarily have all three parts which are present. So as I said, we don't measure intracranial pressure in veterinary patients, and we have to rely on neurological signs to tell us if the intracranial pressure is likely to be increasing. The things that we might see that give us this indication are a decreased mentation or a poor low neurological status, an abnormal behaviour or any abnormal behaviour, respiratory changes because they could indicate the Cushing reflex. Similarly with cardiovascular changes, so we're looking at blood pressure changes in particular and changes in heart rate, but also cardiac arrhythmias. Dilated pupils that don't respond to light. A loss of nystagmus, this would be a loss of nystagmus that's not for a good reason. So if you have an animal with a head injury and it shows nystagmus, and then that nystagmus disappears, but it isn't because the patient is actually getting better, that might be a sign that intracranial pressure is rising. And then at the bottom, I've got a decerebrate posture. Decerebrate is where you have an opisthotonos, which is a backward arching of the head and the body with sort of hyperextension. All four limbs would be rigid and extended. This patient is very much unconscious, and decerebrate posture indicates a severe brainstem injury, with the patient being very, very unlikely to survive. So we have some classic brainstem reflexes that are seen in patients with head injury, namely those that concern the eyes, respirations and body postures. And we're going to look at each of these, but mostly at the eyes and the respiratory reflexes. So the eye reflexes, we have mydriasis and meiosis, which could be unilateral or bilateral. And we've got nystagmus, similarly, which can be unilateral or bilateral. And then we have anisocoria. So anisocoria is unequal pupil size. It can indicate nerve damage, ocular nerve damage after trauma, ocular trauma or cerebral hemorrhage. There is a benign nystagmus and benign anisocoria, but we don't tend to see that in veterinary patients. So this cat here, you can see the eye on the right is large, the pupil is wide and dilated, and the pupil on the left is a normal pupil. So if this was after a traumatic incident, then that would possibly set alarm bells ringing. So we're going to see a video next, and this is a dog which had actually had a brick dropped on its head, or actually it had been thrown on its head, so that's not very nice. Just have a look at the nystagmus that you can see. I believe you can enlarge the video. So we're just about to induce anaesthesia for MRI on this dog, and you can see the nystagmus clearly. We're actually holding his head down because poor chap had no control over his head movements. The respiratory reflexes, I'm not going to go through all of these, but there are some that you'll spot that you're familiar with. The ones on the right-hand side, agonal, which is a gasping, and chain stokes, which is end-stage, end-of-life respiration. Respiratory changes, respiratory patterns that change depending on the pattern can indicate where the damage is in the brain. So for example, on the extreme left we've got BO, BO's breathing, which is a rapid shallow breathing leading to apnea. That can tell us that there's some damage maybe to the medulla oblongata, and certainly that respiratory pattern does indicate raised intracranial pressure. The others, all apart from Cusmar, which is really seen in diabetic ketoacidosis. The others will all tell us that there has been some part of the brain which is damaged, or there's been trauma. And in people, these are seen in stroke people. So to classify traumatic brain injury, well, we use one of two methods. There's primary injury, which is trauma which is incurred as a direct result of injury. So that would be a mechanical injury. So that would be something like the dog with the brick on his head. Because of the composition of brain tissue and the lack of support for the brain, forces aren't well tolerated at all. And we can have various forces which are applied to the brain. So you can have forces which are acceleratory, so they enter at a high speed. Those which are decelerator, so they're suddenly stopped, or rotational forces, and certainly rotational forces are going to have an impact on deep brain tissue, and often that's going to be the brain stem, the medulla oblongata. Secondary brain injury is something which occurs as an indirect result, so it may be subsequent to the primary injury, or it may be a systemic reason that isn't related to the primary injury. Or it may be that there hasn't been a primary injury. So I've listed some here. Others are hypotension, hyperglycemia, or hypoglycemia. I've got hypoxia, hypercapnia, or it may be that the animal's got a really high temperature. The consequences of all of these include increased intracranial pressure. There'll be decreased cerebral delivery of oxygen, and the blood-brain barrier may well become damaged. Often the polytrauma patients, such as those involved in RTA, will have some sort of head injury or brain injury, and it may not be immediately apparent. We've got no control over primary injury, largely, but we can prevent or minimise secondary brain injury and therefore prevent further neuronal death. And while you're assessing your patient prior to anaesthesia, head injury may not be immediately obvious. So if you've got a trauma patient that requires anaesthesia, look out for signs that indicate there's been an injury to the head. So here we've got a dog with a bilateral high femur, so it's bleeding into the anterior chamber of the eye. So there may well be a brain injury, and you can see, certainly you can see on his left eye just here, we've got quite a lot of blood. And I'm not sure that you can see it that well, but there's also on the right hand side as well. And the quicker that we can identify a traumatic brain injury, the better the chances of a positive outcome. Obvious head injury may not be life threatening. Remember, not all head injuries are going to be brain injuries. And so this dog here has just got superficial skin wounds. It's got a bit of a slice to the top of its head. You can see bruising over both eyes, a bit of bruising down his left lateral side of his face, and also has got some superficial skin injuries on his left forelimb. But largely the injuries to his head are just skin and maybe underlying soft tissue. So this doesn't necessarily mean he's got brain injury. But our trauma patients have often got multiple injuries, and many of the polytrauma patients, such as the RTA patients, will have some sort of CNS insult. So here's your classic RTA cat that's got a fractured jaw. And so the fact that it's got a fractured jaw in itself tells us he's had a hard knock to his skull. There's quite a lot of hemorrhage in the right eye, and also to the right side of the face. So we've got dried blood on the face. The right side of the face is actually quite swollen, and there's a little bit of hemorrhage coming from the right ear as well. So those signs tell us that this patient may well have a brain injury. So you need to assess pre-anaesthesia all of your normal vital parameters. The temperature could be high or low, depending on whether the hypothalamus has been damaged, because that's the part of the brain that regulates temperature. Assess the pulse, so you need to get the rate and the rhythm, and also the pattern of both of those. Your abnormal respirations are going to affect oxygenation and ventilation and may well be an indication of the Cushing reflex. Look at the mucous membrane colour, check the CRT. If you can clip the SpO2 probe on the lip or somewhere where you can get a reading, then that will give you an idea, an idea of the saturation of haemoglobin with oxygen. Blood tests are going to be useful. A minimum easy evaluation is packed cell volume, total solids, and blood glucose. If you can do lactate, then that's good. You probably need a blood gas analyzer unless you have the human small handheld lactate analyzer. But when you're getting your blood samples, you need to avoid the jugular vein because you can get increased intracranial pressure from jugular occlusion. So the human Glasgow coma scale is used to assess levels of consciousness and neurological function in humans. And now there's a modified version for veterinary use, which is called the modified Glasgow coma scale. And it's marketed as a small animal coma scale. And it looks at these three areas. So we've got the level of consciousness, motor function, and the pupil size, position, and movements. There's only evidence and data for dogs. It has been used in cats, and you can use it in cats, but there isn't any documented data yet as to its reliability. So the score for each section is from 1, which would be a very severe injury, to 6, which would be the mildest injury. And there are 3 areas that we look at. So the worst possible score is therefore going to be 3, and the best possible score would be 6. So a score of less than 8 would be a grave prognosis, and that patient would have less than 50% chance of survival for longer than 72 hours. The mid-range is 9 to 14, and that would be a guarded prognosis. And the worst score really is 15 to 18, and the best score is 15 to 18, and that would be a very good prognosis for that patient. How frequently you perform the assessment would depend on the severity of the injury. So it may be every hour initially, and that would be done to detect decline or improvement in neurological function, and therefore progression or improvement of the injury. So although this bit isn't immediately related to anaesthesia, it may well be that you're assessing your patient during stabilisation if the intention is to anaesthetise it when it's stable enough. So the next 3 slides, I think, are going to be video clips just to show different parts of neurological assessment. So the first one is the same Labrador that had the brick dropped on his head. We're assessing his motor function here to see if he can get up on his own. I've left the sound on so that you can hear his respiration.
All right, love. Good boy.
So he's trying to get up, but he's not really having much success with that. And you could see there also how his head was waving around, which is why we were holding it down just before we were about to induce anaesthesia. The next video is again of a little dog which is taken prior to CT imaging, so we needed to anaesthetize this dog. Now this dog is circling sort of compulsively and obsessively, always circling anti-clockwise direction. And it spent many days, unfortunately, circling in its kennel. And then the final video is an RTA cat. This cat had a fractured pelvis, which had been repaired apparently successfully, but it then went on to develop these secondary neurological signs. I don't know if you can see, but the cat's asleep, but its forelimb is just making movements of its own, which the cat is not aware of, and also had no control over. You can see there it's sort of reaching out, but the cat itself is actually sleeping or unconscious. And we'll come back to this cat later on in the presentation. So we need to be very careful when we're handling these patients because there may be skull or C-spine fractures that we're not aware of. Oxygen is given non-invasively to avoid stress, and normally using a mask is not possible, nor a nasal prongs because they can lead to sneezing, which will itself increase the intracranial pressure. And then raised intracranial pressure can also develop from pain, so we need to make sure that that's controlled. From vomiting, sneezing and coughing, seizures. If the head is in a downwards position, so if the head's lower than the body, or if the neck is kinked or constricted, so no neck collars should be in place on any patient with known or suspected head injury. We also have to keep stress to a minimum, and that generally includes reducing light and noise stimulation. Communication is important between team members when you're looking after a patient with head injury, and it may be that you use signs on the kennel door to alert everyone to special considerations. I don't know how well you can see that, but in the picture on the right, so I'll just point to it, this top sign here says elevate head by 30 degrees, and I'll explain why the head needs to be elevated later. We've also got lower down no jugular sticks, so that we can't use the jugular vein to get blood from this patient. The dog on the right is on seizure watch, and so we've got a sign on the door that says that. And you can see that the head is raised slightly on a vet bed here. The sign that at the top, if you can see that, says kennel bolter. That's there because the dog has got uncontrolled movements and may fall out of the kennel. It's not that it's actually going to try and make a bid for freedom when you open the door. Temperature control is really very important. In the normal patient, if cerebral autoregulation is working properly, then the blood vessels dilate if the body temperature increases, and they constrict when the body temperature decreases. But in the brain injured patient, autoregulation may not work well, or it may be negatively affected, in which case temperature control can be difficult. So this appliance here, clipped to the door, this blue thing, is a fan because the cat in this kennel had got a very, very high temperature. With your bloods, you also need to monitor electrolytes. And it may be necessary to supplement them via fluid therapy. And blood glucose, also really important. Hyperglycemia must be avoided because that's associated with poor neurological outcomes. And insulin therapy might be necessary if hyperglycemia is persistent. When you're doing your blood glucose levels, you need to make sure you keep the same glucometer with you. So take it with you with your patient. When you're measuring blood glucose under anaesthesia, certainly take that glucometer into theatre with you because different glucometers may be calibrated differently. So just to make sure your results are true. Intravenous fluid therapy is mandatory in patients with brain injury to maintain adequate cerebral perfusion pressure. If raised intracranial pressure is suspected, then a hyperosmolar therapy is needed. So we've got hypertonic saline, which is a hypertonic crystalloid. That's the one on the left of the screen. It's marketed as Vetivex 20. And that's 7.2% saline. If you think normal saline is 0.9%, so 7.2 is 8 times the salinity. And this is given as a bolus. For dogs, it's 4 to 5 mils per kilo. And for cats, it's about 2 to maybe 4 mils per kilo. And that's given over 10 to 15 minutes. And it works by pulling fluid out of the cells and putting it back into the circulation. So after bolusing, it's necessary to go back in and rehydrate the cells using an isotonic crystalloid. And then on the right, we've got a picture of mannitol. Mannitol is an osmotic diuretic, so that increases blood volume, it decreases the viscosity of blood, and it increases the delivery of oxygen to the brain, and it will rapidly bring down a high intracranial pressure. If you're using mannitol, you should give it through a filter because you can get crystal formation at low temperatures or at concentrations of more than 15%. It comes in different concentrations. So you either need a blood giving set or a filter on the end of your giving set. So this photo here is mannitol 20%. And the dose of mannitol is given as grams per kilo, and it's somewhere between 0.25 and 2 grams per kilo, and it's given over anything from 10 to 30 minutes. The concentration shown in the photo, at about half to 1 gram per kilo, it would equate to about 2.5 to 5 mils per kilo. So it has a profound diuretic effect, and it can cause a severe volume depletion. So again, an isotonic crystalloid has got to be given after mannitol. I've put a picture in the middle of Voluven, or Volulite as it's now called, which is a colloid. But the use of colloid for head injuries is now controversial, and it should only be used if intracranial pressure is not raised. So normally, the fluid therapy that we'd use during anaesthesia would be a non-glucose isotonic crystalloid at 3 to 5 mils per kilo per hour. And at that dose, it should prevent over-infusion and raised intracranial pressure. The main goals of anaesthesia for a patient with head injuries are to preserve the brain tissue and neuronal function and to prevent secondary neuronal injury. We must maintain cerebral perfusion, as hypoxemia leads to cerebral vasodilation and therefore an increase in intracranial pressure. And neuronal function is dependent on adequate blood flow, and that, of course, is altered by anaesthesia. We also got to make sure we preserve venous drainage from the head, which we can do with positioning in the head-up position, and that's at about 15 to 30 degrees. As long as spinal injuries are not present. When positioning, it's important to make sure that the neck is level and straight and not crooked at an angle, because that will cause jugular occlusion. So we need to incline the head and the neck, and ideally the entire body. And we aim for normocapnia, so normal end-tidal CO2 levels, because that will mean we would have a normal pH of blood and cerebrospinal fluid, and therefore a normal size of blood vessels and a constant cerebral blood flow. So under anaesthesia, we aim for around 40 millimetres of mercury end-tidal CO2. Very slightly lower than that is okay, but not lower than 30 millimetres of mercury. And we'll look at why that's important next. And this is something which has changed in veterinary medicine over the past sort of 5 years or so. So to look at the relationship between carbon dioxide and intracranial pressure, eucapnia is just another name for normocapnia. So this is normal end-tidal CO2 levels, which are virtually the same as the normal tension of arterial concentration of CO2 in arterial blood. So when we've got this eucapnia, normocapnia, we've got a normal size of blood vessel and therefore a constant flow of blood through it. So here we've got the vessel, it's a nice size, and this is the blood flowing through the vessels. When we have hypercapnia, so you've got an increased CO2, so we're looking here at more than 45, and that would mean that there's an increased tension of CO2 in arterial blood, then that will cause acidosis, so that will decrease the pH of extracellular fluid being blood and CSF. And that means the cerebral vessels dilate, and so blood flow through them is increased, and therefore intracranial pressure is increased. So you can see here we've got a pouching out here of the blood vessel, and so it's allowing more blood to flow through and up to the brain, and therefore your intracranial pressure will be increased. And that same sort of reaction occurs when we have hypoxemia as well. And then on the other end of the scale, we have hypocapnia. So we've got a decreased end-tidal CO2, which is the same as a decreased arterial CO2. So we're looking here between 25 to 30 millimetres of mercury. So in this instance, we will get alkalosis, which means that the pH of extracellular fluid is increased. And so what happens now is our cerebral vessels constrict, so we get vasoconstriction. So you can see here there's a constriction, and therefore the blood can't flow through them, and that means we have cerebral ischemia, so the brain becomes less well perfused. So this is why CO2 levels are really important to monitor in head injury patients. I'm just going to touch on drugs, because although obviously drug choices are the up to the veterinary surgeon, it's important for the nurses to understand why some drugs are chosen and why others are not chosen. Benzodiazepines will have minimal cardiovascular effects, and they can be antagonized with flumazenil, so your diazepam and midazolam can be used. The full mu opioids, they're easy to reverse. They've got minimal cardiovascular effects, and obviously they give superior analgesia, which these brain injured patients need. We don't use morphine, though, because that can cause vomiting and therefore raise the intracranial pressure. But at clinical doses, opioids have got minimal effects on intracranial pressure. The alpha-2 agonist agents, we don't use those, or if we do, we need to be very, very careful, because they will decrease the heart rate and cardiac output, and they will therefore decrease cerebral perfusion pressure. And so if you're going to use them, they should only be used at very, very low doses, and only if sedation is absolutely necessary. The bradycardia and increase in the mean arterial pressure that occurs with alpha-2s may actually stimulate the Cushing reflex, so that's another reason to avoid them. But normally these patients only need analgesia for pre-medication. Induction is usually with propofol. Up until fairly recently, propofol was reported to have some neuroprotective properties, but there was a review back along in 2013 which concluded that there wasn't really any evidence to support this. So propofol generally will cause cardiovascular depression, and it will decrease blood pressure and cause hypotension. Just skip alfaxolone for a moment. Etomidate I know is not used in general practice much, if at all, but it may be that somebody is in referral. And etomidate is a drug which is cardiovascular stable, and it maintains cerebral perfusion and it with decreased intracranial pressure. So etomidate does have cerebroneuroprotective properties. But if you're going to use that, then a benzodiazepine must always be used with it, because you get very, very poor muscle relaxation and myoclonus, which is uncontrolled jerky movements. So alfaxolone, it's probably okay to use for head injury, but there isn't any data yet to support its use. Co-induction of propofol with a benzodiazepine is useful, because it means you can use a lower dose of your propofol. So you use something like propofol and midazolam, or propofol and diazepam. And historically, ketamine was thought to increase intracranial pressure, but it's now known that in adequately ventilated patients, there's either no change in intracranial pressure or maybe a decrease. So the ICP has been shown to go down, as well as the EEG activity. So it may actually have some neuroprotective properties. So we need to pre-oxygenate these patients with no stress, and generally that means flow-by. The functional residual capacity is decreased, meaning that hypoxia during induction is possible, and pre-oxygenation will delay the time it takes to get to hypoxia. If you can use a mask, then that will increase the inspired concentration of oxygen the most, but obviously not if the mask itself causes stress. And don't attempt tracheal intubation until you know that your animal is deep enough, because we do have to avoid coughing and gagging. Sometimes we give 2 mg per kg IV lidocaine in dogs prior to intubation, just to suppress that cough reflex. For cats, you're going to spray the larynx with Intubees, and then you must wait a good 60 seconds before attempting to pass a tube. So it's well worth actually timing, but with a clock with a second hand, to wait your 60 seconds. And you do need competent intubation. Ideally, we need to be able to pass a tube sort of first time. Anaesthesia is usually maintained with isoflurane or sevoflurane, but both of these agents will cause vasodilation and increased intracranial pressure when administered at more than one times the MAC value. So try and keep the concentration as low as possible. The MAC values are 1.2% for isoflurane and about 2.4% for SIVO. Analgesic CRIs and other multimodal methods should be considered. So if you can maybe do a nerve block using a local anaesthetic, that would be a good thing to do. Or it may be that you just use total intravenous anaesthesia and no inhalant agent. You'd still need to intubate your patient and administer oxygen, but you just don't give it the inhalant. And nitrous oxide isn't used because that definitely does increase intracranial pressure. There is some evidence to suggest that lidocaine infusion improves neurological outcome in patients with cerebral ischemia, and it protects the brain against hypoxia. So that might be something worth considering if you can do a lidocaine infusion. Steroids aren't used. The crash trials in people in the early 2000s showed that the use of corticosteroids is associated with increased mortality. The CRASH trials, that's an acronym which stands for corticosteroid randomization after significant head injury. And it was a study of the effect of corticosteroids on death or severe disability in people who had had, adult people who had had head injuries. And the trial used over 10,000 people, and they were either given a corticosteroid or a placebo, with their permission, obviously, or the permission of their next of kin. And that was given within 8 hours of injury, and the results were documented. After 6 months, the results showed that there was increased risk of death or severe disability in the corticosteroid group. And the results didn't depend on how severe the initial injury had been. So whether it was severe or minor, the people who had had the corticosteroids either died or were left with severe disability. We don't have that type of research in veterinary patients. And because we take much of our research from the human field, the veterinary sector has followed their advice. So we don't use steroids. So for monitoring under anaesthesia, there are various things that we need to make sure do happen. And obviously, like with most things, we need to monitor as much as possible and use whatever equipment you have. Cardiac output must be maintained, and that's done with intravenous fluid therapy. So as I said, at normal GA rates, that's 5 mils per kilo per hour for a dog and 3 mils per kilo per hour for cats. We need to maintain oxygenation and ventilation because altered levels of oxygen and CO2 in arterial blood will affect blood flow to the brain and intracranial pressure. The question about whether or not to artificially ventilate these patients is a difficult one. You need to weigh up the need to ventilate in order to maintain normocapnia against the downsides, which are reduced venous return and therefore hypotension. If you've got a mechanical ventilator, then it's recommended that you use low peak inspiratory pressures because they should not significantly affect intracranial pressure. If you haven't, then and you need to do it by hand, then you can't generally measure the peak inspiratory pressure unless you had a separate manometer. Measure the blood pressure and keep the mean arterial pressure over 70 to 80 millimetres of mercury. The neurologists actually like that to be 80 to 100 millimetres of mercury. Remember that MAP is the main driver for cerebral blood flow. And if you've got the means, then support the blood pressure with drugs if necessary. So the commonly used drugs are, in the picture, dobutamine, dopamine, ephedrine, noradrenaline, and phenylephrine. And then just whatever other monitoring you can do, just make sure you perform it. Use your SpO2. If you've only got a pulse oximeter and an esophageal stethoscope, then that's all you can use. But if you've got a Doppler hiding in the cupboard somewhere, then now's the time to get it out and dust it off and use it. So if you've got a multi-parameter monitor, that's great. You can monitor all of these signs. Try and keep the SpO2 over 97%, because 95% may be the beginning of desaturation, and hypoxemia will cause the blood vessels in the brain to dilate, and therefore your intracranial pressure will be raised. Aim for normocapnia, or maybe very slightly low. If you've got a ventilator, then you can manipulate your values. If you haven't and you need to, then you're going to have to perform manual IPPV with a suitable circuit. ECG allows observation of waves and complexes, and changes in your ECG can indicate imminent crisis. Your heart rate, respiratory rate, and blood pressure they can be used together to indicate Cushing reflex, and obviously your temperature, because that can be high or low. At the bottom I've put ABG, arterial blood gas analysis. If you have the means to do blood gases, then that will enable you to monitor the adequacy of pulmonary function. But a blood gas sample will only give you the parameters at the time that you've taken the sample. It's not an ongoing monitoring method. So when you're moving into anaesthesia or into theatre or in between places, try and keep the head raised as much as you can. So tilt the table up at the cranial end, no more than 30 degrees. The range is between 15 and 30 degrees. If the angle is more than 30 degrees, the cerebral perfusion pressure will be decreased. So here we've got a boxer who's being moved from induction area onto MRI, and we're lucky that we've got a table that tilts at the cranial end, so we're able to keep his head raised slightly. And then after anaesthesia, early extubation prevents gagging. Obviously, constant monitoring is needed if you've extubated early, but it would be needed for your head trauma patients anyway. Recovery has got to be calm and stress-free, so you need a quiet environment, no barking dogs or clanging metal cage doors. Maybe dim the lights. Supplemental oxygen should be given if possible, so if you've got the means to do bedside oxygen, that would be great. And of course, the head and neck still need to be slightly inclined. Now, I've put here dexmedetomidine or medetomidine CRI might be needed. So obviously, these are alpha-2 agents, but they're okay to use as CRI because we're only using them as micro doses. And they will also help provide analgesia, which an analgesia must be maintained during the recovery period, because that's going to bring about a stress response if they are in pain. So you don't want any breakthrough pain occurring. So again, positioning your head and chest. This is the same little cat that we saw in the video that had the secondary neurological signs. This cat actually ended up having its hind leg amputated, so he did need, extensive anaesthesia. So keep your head up 15 to 30 degrees as long as there aren't any spinal injuries. And it's best to incline the entire patient on a board if you can, because then you can just incline the whole body so that there's no risk of occlusion of the neck vessels by raising the head alone. So underneath all this bedding, this patient is on a spinal board, and that means that we can keep the neck straight. If you just put the head up on a load of vet beds or towels, then it may be that you've occluded the jugular vein. Ongoing post-op care, then if the patient is conscious and can swallow, then feed it, offer it food and water when it's awake. The food and water will probably need to be in shallow bowls within easy reach, or it may be that they need to be hand-fed. Sometimes we need to tube feed them. We tend to avoid nasoesophageal tubes because of the tendency for them to sneeze, which obviously will raise the intracranial pressure. And aspiration pneumonia can also be a risk. So this little cat here, again, another polytrauma RTA cat, and it's got a little injury on its head. You can see it's got a bit of fur missing near its right ear and two broken front legs. And so If you're going to anaesthetise the patient, then an esophagostomy tube would be the one of choice. If your patient's recumbent, then it's going to need to be turned every 4 hours, but don't forget to use sternal recumbency as well as the two laterals if it's conscious, because that will improve their demeanour. It gives them a different view on the world and makes them feel better if they are propped up in sternal rather than if they're always lying on one side. And of course, it has the physiological benefits of meaning that both lungs can inflate at the same time. If you haven't got an indwelling urinary catheter, then bladder management may be necessary. You need to be very careful when manually expressing the bladder, because abdominal compressions can also lead to raised intracranial pressure. So you need to do it quite gently. And if it's an ongoing problem, then an indwelling urinary catheter will be needed. So to sum up then, the effects of anaesthetic agents on intracranial hemodynamics and neuronal injury are really very complex. And cerebral perfusion pressure is affected by many things. Some of them we have no control over, but secondary effects result from alterations of things like the cardiovascular function and respiratory function. And we can monitor and try and regulate these things. And although it's important to be aware of why some drugs are used and other drugs are avoided, it's just as important, if not more so, to make sure we monitor the patient carefully at all times and support cardiovascular and respiratory functions as necessary. And in that way, we can try and keep the anaesthetised head patient safe under anaesthesia. Thank you very much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Denise for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.